It took me a while to recognize them in the crowd. When the sliding doors first parted, all I could make out was the blur of smiling, anxious faces tilted over the guardrail. Eventually, I spotted a tall, silver-haired man towards the rear of the crowd, with a short, owlish woman barely visible beside him. Toot gathered me into a hug and tossed candy and chewing gum Lays around my neck. Gramps threw an arm over my shoulder. They took me to the new car they had bought, and Gramps showed me how to operate the air conditioning. We drove along the highway, past fast food restaurants and economy motels, and used car lots strung with festoons. I told them about the trip and everyone back in Jakarta. Gramps told me what they'd planned for my welcome back dinner. Toot suggested I needed new clothes for school. Then, suddenly, the conversation stopped. I realized that I was to live with strangers. The new arrangement hadn't sounded so bad when my mother first explained it to me. It was time for me to attend an American school, she had said. I'd run through all the lessons in my correspondence course. She said that she and Maya would be joining me in Hawaii very soon, a year, tops, and that she'd try to make it there for Christmas. She reminded me of what a great time I'd had living with Gramps and Toot just the previous summer. The ice cream, the cartoons, the days at the beach. And you won't have to wake up at 4 in the morning, she said, a point that I found most compelling. It was only now, as I began to adjust to an indefinite stay and watch my grandparents in the rhythm of their schedules, that I realized how much the two of them had changed. After my mother and I had left, they had sold the big rambling house near the university and now rented a small 2-bedroom apartment in a high-rise on Baratania Street. Gramps had left the furniture business to become a life insurance agent, but as he was unable to convince himself that people needed what he was selling and was sensitive to rejection, the work went badly. Every Sunday night, I would watch him grow more and more irritable as he gathered up his briefcase and set up a TV tray in front of his chair, following the lead of every possible distraction until he would finally chase us out of the living room and try to schedule appointments with prospective clients over the phone. Sometimes I would tiptoe into the kitchen for a soda, and I could hear the desperation creeping out of his voice, the stretch of silence that followed when the people on the other end explained why Thursday wasn't good and Tuesday not much better, and then Gramps' heavy sigh after he had hung up the phone, his hands fumbling through the files in his lap like those of a card player who's deep in the hole. Often, my grandparents argued, an argument rooted in the rarely mentioned fact that Toot earned more money than Gramps. She had proved to be a trailblazer of sorts, the first woman vice president of a local bank. And although Gramps liked to say he always encouraged her in her career, her job had become a source of delicacy and bitterness between them, as his commissions paid fewer and fewer of the family's bills. Not that Toot had anticipated her success. Without a college education, she had started out as a secretary to help defray the costs of my unexpected birth. But she had a quick mind and sound judgment, and the capacity for sustained work. Slowly she had risen, playing by the rules, until she reached the threshold where competence didn't suffice. There she would stay for 20 years, with scarcely a vacation, watching her male counterparts keep moving up the corporate ladder, playing a bit loose with information passed on between the 9th hole and the ride to the clubhouse, becoming wealthy men. More than once, my mother would tell Toot that the bank shouldn't get away with such blatant sexism. But Toot would just poo-poo my mother's remarks, saying that everybody could find a reason to complain about something. Toot didn't complain. Every morning she woke up at 5 a.m. and changed from the frowsy muumuus she wore around the apartment into a tailored suit and high-heeled pumps. Her face powdered, her hips girdled, her thinning hair bolstered, she would board the 6:30 bus to arrive at her downtown office before anyone else. From time to time she would admit a grudging pride in her work, and took pleasure in telling us the inside story behind the local financial news. When I got older, though, she would confide in me that she had never stopped dreaming of a house with a white picket fence, days spent baking or playing bridge or volunteering at the local library. I was surprised by this admission, for she rarely mentioned hopes or regrets. It may or may not have been true that she would have preferred the alternative history she imagined for herself, but I came to understand that her career spanned a time when the work of a wife outside the home was nothing to brag about, for her or for Gramps, that it represented only lost years, broken promises. What Toot believed kept her going were the needs of her grandchildren and the stoicism of her ancestors. "So long as you kids do well, Bear," she would say more than once, "that's all that really matters." That's how my grandparents had come to live. They still prepared sashimi for the now infrequent guests to their apartment. Gramps still wore Hawaiian shirts to the office, and Toot still insisted on being called Toot. Otherwise, though, the ambitions they had carried with them to Hawaii had slowly drained away, until regularity of schedules and pastimes and the weather became their principal consolation. They would occasionally grumble about how the Japanese had taken over the islands, how the Chinese controlled island finance. During the Watergate hearings, my mother would pry out of them that they had voted for Nixon, the law and order candidate, in 1968. We didn't go to the beach or on hikes together anymore. At night, Gramps watched television while Toot sat in her room reading murder mysteries. Their principal excitement now came from new drapes or a standalone freezer. It was as if they had bypassed the satisfaction that should come with the middle years, the convergence of maturity with time left, energy with means, a recognition of accomplishment that frees the spirit. At some point in my absence, they had decided to cut their losses and settle for hanging on. They saw no more destinations to hope for.